From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And attention is on a hearing room in Washington again today as Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg is testifying before Congress, today taking questions from the House Committee on Energy and Commerce. Yesterday, he took 5 hours of questions from about 40 senators on a range of issues, including Russian influence in the 2016 election, regulation, and as Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn put it, who controls user data?
Mr. Zuckerberg, I tell you, I think your cozy community is beginning to look a whole lot like the Truman Show, where people's identities and relationships are made available to people that they don't know. And then that data is crunched and it is used, and they are fully unaware of this. So I've got to ask you, I think what we're getting to here is, who owns the virtual you?
Who owns the virtual you? NPR's Miles Parks has been following all of this. Miles, Zuckerberg wore the grown-up suit, ditched the hoodie. A photographer snapped a picture of the notes he's been using, including talking points about questions over whether he'd resign. What's the sense of how he's doing?
I think the general sense, Robin, is that he's doing really well. And I think part of that, honestly, comes from the fact that over the last 10 years, we've had this huge narrative about how bad Mark Zuckerberg was in public, specifically from, I think, from the movie The Social Network, which kind of paints him as a very, very awkward speaker. In front of Congress, he looked pretty put together. Like you said, he had the suit going. He never really stumbled. He had his opening statement completely memorized. And he looked poised. He was never really locked into a situation with a senator or a congressperson for longer than a couple seconds where he wasn't able to wiggle out to get to one of his talking points about how much good Facebook does for the world or why advertising is necessary on the platform, things that he clearly he's been preparing for this for weeks, and it did show.
Well, you used
the other thing to note is that it seems like investors feel that way, too. The Facebook stock ended up almost 5% at the end of the day yesterday.
Well, a couple of things. You used the phrase wiggle out. We'll get to that in a second. But to Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn's question, that was today as Congress, the House was questioning him. Who owns the virtual you? What did he say?
He said, you do. He's been asked that multiple times, and every time he goes back to the Facebook user agreement, which inherently says the person who posts or just chooses to share owns their own data, and if when they choose to delete it, that Facebook will delete that completely from the platform. But that is something that they have really tried to drill down on and get him on the record saying that it is up to it. It is the users who own their own data. So that way, going forward, they can have him saying that on the record for when they do. When regulation, whether it's years down the road, that is going to be something that it comes back to in terms of making sure very clearly that it's not the platforms who controls when that data is deleted.
But it is not true that users own their material. If, in fact, a professor can have the right through an app legally to download information, which is what happened, and then he sells that to Cambridge Analytica, you don't own it if somebody else owns it.
Yeah, and I think that's really just kind of goes back to the inherent argument of Zuckerberg would argue that now that they've locked down the ways that these apps can use your data, you have gone through and chosen to sign up for those apps and consented. At this point, we're not talking about years ago in 2014 when the Cambridge Analytica story began where they were able to scrape the data of friends of friends and things like that. Now, Zuckerberg would argue that all the data that apps and other people that use Facebook have from people is things that they have consented to specifically and signed up for.
Yeah. And there seemed to be some confusion in the room. You could hear it in the questioning. Here's Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah speaking yesterday. Maybe not confusion, but there was a lot of, you know, basic questioning. He's referring back to when he met with Zuckerberg in Washington in 2010.
You said back then that Facebook would always be free. Is that still your objective?
Senator, yes. There will always be a version of Facebook that is free. It is our mission to try to help connect everyone around the world and to bring the world closer together. In order to do that, we believe that we need to offer a service that everyone can afford, and we're committed to doing that.
Well, if so, how do you sustain a business model in which users don't pay for your service?
Senator, we run ads.
Well, and as we also understand, Miles Parks, they sell data.
They do, indeed. And I think you hear really in that exchange, this one of the biggest storylines to come out of this testimony is the huge divide between the people who are asking the questions, the senators and the representatives, and somebody like Mark Zuckerberg, who has lived his entire life online, basically. There is just kind of an inherent – I think Zuckerberg prepared for this testimony thinking he was going to be asked – a few more complex technical questions, and a lot of it has gone back to that basic, who owns this data, how does Facebook work? And I think that has frustrated a lot of people who are hoping to get a few more very specific answers about not only the Cambridge Analytica story, but also the Russian interference story and how something like troll farms, Russian troll farms, or people who are hoping to misuse Facebook to influence populations, how Facebook technically is actually going to be fighting those operations, because a lot of this has just been so broad because the questions, like hatches, have been so broad
and
almost
simplistic. They reflect the average American who may have the same questions and not have understanding. And we're going to stop you there, Miles Parks, who's going to be following Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg for NPR all day. So thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And we have an update now on a story we covered on the show earlier in the week. A small town in New Mexico shut down a program that gave citizen volunteers permission to carry a concealed weapon anywhere in the country. On Monday, we spoke with Bloomberg Businessweek reporter Zachary Miter, who told us the police department in Lake Arthur, New Mexico, had given a badge to the conservative billionaire Robert Mercer. Now, Mercer is the money behind Breitbart News and Cambridge Analytica, the political data firm we were just talking about. Zach Miter, welcome back. What's happened since we last spoke?
Sure. So lots happened. In the town of Lake Arthur, New Mexico, the mayor actually shut down the police reserve program that Robert Mercer took advantage of. And he also placed the police chief who oversaw it on administrative leave.
The mayor's name is Isidro Salazar. What else is he saying about his motivations for doing that?
He's saying the police chief had good intentions, but the program kind of got out of control. And we've learned a lot more about the program since our first story. In fact, a lot of other interesting people had these Lake Arthur badges, which essentially made them police officers. And the reason that was so valuable for people all over the country, people had no connection to New Mexico, is it gave them the right to carry a concealed weapon in all 50 states, a perk that's only available to police officers.
Right. So this program got so big, you report that 150 reserve officers were available for a town of 433 people. And just tell me more about who some of those 150 reserve officers were. What else have you learned in the last couple of days?
Oh, sure. So we found out that a whole bunch of elite bodyguards, Navy SEALs and people like that, who guard the Koch brothers, the, you know, Kansas billionaires who are active in conservative politics, a whole bunch of their bodyguards all had these Lake Arthur badges. Dan Bilzerian, the so-called king of Instagram, who's kind of famous for posing on the social media site with topless models and machine guns, also for several years was a Lake Arthur police officer.
Do you have any reason to believe that there is a connection between those groups of people, that in fact the Koch brother security guards or bodyguards may have known about this program in conservative circles along with people like Robert Mercer?
That's a great question. My guess is the connection was really more the circles of kind of elite gun enthusiasts and executive protection people. And at the same time that, you know, another thing you can say about it is that this was kind of an open secret among a certain class of elites in the United States, that either they or their bodyguards that were guarding them could kind of have access to this secret license that nobody else in the country really has access to.
You've reported that Robert Mercer is no longer a member of the Lake Arthur Volunteer Police Force. Of course, it wouldn't matter now that it's been shut down. But have you found out any information about whether he has this privilege on another police force somewhere else across the country?
We're working on that story right now.
Okay. Again, the idea is that this is not just about Lake Arthur, that these programs do exist all over the country. Isn't that right?
Yeah, there are various programs. Basically, anybody who's a police chief or a sheriff has the ability to kind of designate people as police officers with very little oversight. There isn't any kind of centralized, you know, set of qualifications that everyone has to do to become a police officer. And these can be volunteer designations. And so a lot of times it can be in exchange for a donation to the department, or maybe because somebody's a former Navy SEAL and you think they're really cool and you want to hang out with them, you can give them a badge.
But could I just play devil's advocate, because I know there are people who would make the argument to say that these are valuable programs, that in small police forces, it's an important way to help boost the staffing, and that they actually create a lot of value in a community.
Oh, sure. And a lot of police departments have auxiliary programs. Those are the people you see directing traffic and doing things like that. It's very rare to see programs, volunteer programs like that, where every officer has HR 218 status. That's the ability to carry a concealed weapon nationwide. You can have volunteer programs to help out the police without designating them as full commissioned police officers.
That's Zachary Miter. He's a reporter for Bloomberg News. Zach, thanks for your reporting and thanks for talking to us about it.
Glad to be here.
So do guns save lives? You know the bumper sticker, the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. But what are the statistics on defensive gun use? Well, they're competing. Criminologist Gary Kleck claims there are millions of defensive gun uses, or DGUs, every year, and pro-gun advocates cite his work. But many other researchers insist it's nowhere near true, that a gun in the home for defensive use is more likely to be used in a crime or a suicide. It's a debate that can get pretty heated. A gun in the home for defensive use is at the heart of the guns rights movement. And today we hear from both sides, starting with criminologist Gary Kleck of Florida State University. Gary, hi.
Hello.
And you are one who feels that there's a huge number of the successful defensive uses of guns. But results from the National Crime Victimization Survey, which we know you're familiar with, it's administered by the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics, they suggest an annual number of DGUs below 60,000. Your 1992 estimate was 2 million, and you've told us it's maybe 1 million now. So 1 million compared to about 60,000. How did you come to that number?
Well, actually, the NCVS, they've never directly asked any respondents specifically about defensive gun use. They just give people an opportunity to volunteer that. So there is no valid NCVS-based estimate. But there are no less than 19 professionally conducted national surveys. Mine was just one of them. And every last one of them indicates on the order of a million or more defensive gun uses per year.
Well, let's take a look at some of the criticism of your research. For instance, respondents were asked whether they fired their guns, and if so, whether they managed to hit the mark. And the responses were yes, that they hit the mark many times. And people who have looked at your research say that that would have meant that something like 132,000 perpetrators were either wounded or killed at the hands of these armed civilians. This is in the 90s. And that number was just about the same as the total of all people who were shot or killed or received treatment for non-fatal gunshot wounds in an emergency room that year. But those people were the result of criminal assault or suicide attempts or accidents. In other words, people can't seem to find the people who were shot by citizens defending themselves. They don't seem to show up in hospital records.
Well, that's partly because if you put yourself in the position of a criminal who was attempting to rob somebody and then they got shot by their victim, you'd be insane to go to an emergency room and say, please treat my gunshot wound, because the medical personnel are required by law to tell the police this guy came in and was treated for a gunshot wound, and then he'd have to explain how he got that wound. Well, it's not surprising that it would be very unusual that that sort of criminal wounded as a result of a defensive gun use didn't seek medical treatment. Only 7% of the people who told us they had a defensive gun use were wounded.
But in the other cases, you'd think if it was a million or 2 million, we'd hear about it a lot more. Why don't we hear about it?
Who would have an incentive to let somebody hear about it? Who are you going to tell? If you tell the police, I just wielded a gun pointing a deadly weapon at another human being and claimed it was in self-defense, the police are going to investigate that, and they may well, in the short run, arrest you and treat you as a criminal until and unless you are cleared.
Do you think there is lower crime in areas where more people own guns in the home for defensive uses?
Well, not necessarily, because as I say, there's both good and bad effects of people having guns. And the more you're talking about a high crime neighborhood, the more you're talking about a place where a larger and larger proportion of the people who have guns are criminals or violence prone. And guns in the hands of those sorts of people is a bad thing. It tends to increase violence. Whereas people who would only be involved in violence as victims, for them to have guns and to use them occasionally for self-protection is a good thing.
What's the one thing you'd want people to know about your research?
Well, that it does support universal background checks. It's documented both the violence-elevating effects of guns in the hands of criminals and the violence-reducing effects of guns in the hands of non-criminals. And I've evaluated 19 distinct categories of gun control, and two of the kinds that seem to reduce violence are basically permit and licensing systems, and what they have in common is a background check. Right now, we have background checks that only cover dealer sales, but most criminals get their guns from sources other than licensed gun dealers. So that's my support for the notion we should expand background checks to encompass private transfers.
Gary Kleck, criminologist at Florida State University. Gary, thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's bring in David Hemenway, a professor at Harvard School of Public Health. David, you and Gary Kleck have sparred on this for years. Start with your response to his theory that government numbers are so low, and his are accurate, because people who use a gun to defend themselves won't report it because they're afraid of being arrested or not believed.
I don't know why he would think that. It's they bought the gun for self-defense. There's no evidence to indicate that that would be true.
You're questioning his research. We wondered it, too, if there were as many as a million, half of what the original number, 2 million, a few years ago. You feel you would hear anecdotally about that. I mean, is that part of your point that we'd be hearing about this?
Well, when you try to validate that kind of number, a million, it doesn't make any sense at all. There should be at least some number of newspaper reports, at least 5 or 10% of the time. You should have 100,000 or more newspaper reports every year. What a great story.
You hear about it.
Grandmother prevents this evil person from shooting up her place or robbing things. This is a great tremendous news. And, of course, you don't hear it because it didn't happen.
Well, but how do you explain that your survey and his survey, both considered legitimate by different scholars, have such different conclusions?
Yeah. Well, it's not my survey. It's the National Crime Victimization Survey. This is probably the most sophisticated criminal survey in the world. And it tries to eliminate the big problems that you find if you just call people up. There is consensus in the field. I survey gun researchers, and I've asked them, for example, how much do you agree with this statement? In the United States, there are more than a million self-defense gun uses each year. So it's about 100 people answer. 20-1, the researchers who look at this say, this is just bad science. It's a well-known problem in epidemiology that if something's a rare event and you just try to ask how many people have done this, you will get incredible overestimates.
Why? Because people want to say that? Why is that?
When you're asking about a rare event, if you ask, did you give blood in the last 6 months? They maybe gave blood 9 months ago. They were planning to give blood. Their partner gave blood. Whatever it is, we don't know exactly, but we know it's always the case.
It's always inflated.
As long as it's not a completely negative thing. If she said, "Did you kick your wife in the teeth yesterday?"
No.
Yeah. But anything that's neutral or positive, and self-defense gun use is a positive thing. That's the reason to have a gun.
But what about the hard, cold facts of emergency rooms? Now, he says that the reason that we're not seeing all these people who had been shot is that the people who have been shot, since they were in the course of a crime, don't go to hospitals.
So we know if they didn't go to hospitals, they would end up, a lot of them would end up in hospitals with sepsis or other major problems. If you don't get your gunshot wound treated, you'd end up in some hospital, and there's none of these people who do. We've actually tried to figure this out. So when people are first incarcerated, they have all these medical exams with no police around, but they have medical exams with the doctor and the doctors and nurses. They ask them about, do you smoke and have you ever had emphysema and on and on and on and on and on, all these things. Mm-hmm. And then they also say you've been shot, and a lot of people say yes. But then they say, what happened when you were shot? They all say they went to the hospital. They all can explain which hospital they went to. But Gary Kleck claims that maybe 200,000 people a year, bad guys, are shot. And in emergency departments and in the morgue, we typically only see maybe 130,000, all of whom we think are good guys or suicide victims or accident victims.
Yeah, you can trace their gunshot wounds to other things and not defensive guns. He also seems to be saying that, okay, let's say people in suburban neighborhoods are buying guns to protect themselves, and that is a good thing. They seem to be protecting themselves. Just the notion that people might know that there are guns there is deflective of crime.
There's no evidence that guns make people safer. There just isn't any.
Does it matter, though, if in one home somewhere in the United States, one person can say, I defended my family?
No, there's no question that you can find a case where someone was better off with a gun. You can find a case where someone was better off drinking alcohol. You can find a case where someone was better off not wearing their seatbelt. You can find a lot of cases, but what you're saying is sort of in the aggregate, people have guns for protection against strangers. Strangers are not who's going to get you. Basically, the average person, and even Gary Kleck will admit this, has basically no chance in their lifetime ever to use a gun in self-defense. But they have every day they have a chance to use the gun inappropriately. They have a chance to get angry. They get scared. They get depressed. Their kids find the guns and somebody commits suicide. Someone has a gun accident. Somebody steals the gun and uses it on somebody else. There's all these horrible things that can happen, and they overwhelm any possible benefit.
David Hemenway, professor of health policy at the Harvard School of Public Health, director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. David, thank you.
All right, thank you.
So two sets of research there. We welcome your thoughts, but here's a quick note about other gun research. Young people have been at the center of the gun debate since the Parkland shooting. This afternoon on All Things Considered, we'll hear about a new generation of researchers who are hoping to prevent gun-related violence by better understanding what drives it. That's later today on ATC. And again, your thoughts on DGUs, defensive gun use. Welcome now at hearnow.org. FDA has released new draft guidelines that would allow pregnant women to be involved in more clinical drug trials. Nearly 4 million pregnant women in the U.S. every year don't know which drugs are safe because there's a hesitancy to include them in trials. Megan Thielking is a reporter with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Megan, the big question is, how can drug companies ever test on pregnant women if they could possibly harm the fetus?
So this has been a concern for a long time, and there are obviously ethical concerns about exposing a pregnant woman or her fetus to an untested drug, but there's also an argument to be made that not testing any drugs means you're exposing millions of pregnant women every year to untested medications that we don't know if they're safe or effective to take during pregnancy. Almost every medication that's given to a pregnant woman is considered off-label, meaning it hasn't been proven safe or effective for them to take. Because the body changes so much during pregnancy, standard doses of drugs might be too high or too low for a pregnant woman. So these guidelines are the latest step that the federal government has taken to sort of look at this problem and look at how we can address it. There's also a task force looking at it, and now the FDA is getting involved.
So let's start with some of the things they're saying, including what to do with women who become pregnant while they're in a clinical trial. What's the advice there?
So what the FDA is suggesting is that if a woman does become pregnant when she's already enrolled in a clinical trial, researchers should just tell her whether or not she's getting an experimental drug or she's getting a placebo. That way she can make a decision about whether the potential benefits of staying in the trial, whether those are for her or for her fetus, will outweigh the risks of exposure. I think it's certainly a complicated calculation to make, and the FDA asks that any clinical trial that involves a pregnant woman poses minimal risk to a fetus. So there are certainly a lot of considerations to be made.
So that's women who might get pregnant during a trial. But back to the big headline here, which is that the FDA is saying that pregnancy is not a bar to women being in a trial.
I think there's certainly a huge push to get more pregnant women involved in clinical trials. I think it's a little early to know what the pharmaceutical industry is going to think about this guidance. So the FDA just released this as a draft guidance, which means they're willing to take comments from doctors, from pregnant women, from the drug industry. And we haven't heard yet what the drug industry really thinks of this guidance. But I do think broadly there's a change happening on the federal level to get more pregnant women involved in research. And we might see some drug companies follow their lead.
Yeah. Well, as it says, there have to have been preclinical studies already done. So there are some requirements, but no drug company is going to want to be the one responsible if something goes wrong and it's not just the woman, it's the fetus that's involved. We should also mention there's ethical questions, and one that's been a little controversial has to do with the father's consent. The father's consent could be required in some cases?
Yeah, so it's a really small part of the guidance, but it's one that some people have already pointed out. And essentially, the health department, the federal health department, already has these requirements in place for studies that are paid for or conducted by the health department. And one of those guidelines is that it requires a father's consent for a pregnant woman to be involved in a clinical trial if the benefit is just for the fetus and it's not for her. So they ask for a mother and a father's consent. There are obviously exclusions to that, but that's been criticized before, and the argument is just that a pregnant woman's consent should be enough. And now that the FDA is suggesting that drug companies also follow all those same guidelines that the health department already has, that one point is being scrutinized again.
That's Megan Thielking, a reporter at STAT. We'll link you to her writing at herenow.org. Megan, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we've been looking this week at a new report from the Congressional Budget Office that predicts the federal deficit will balloon past $1 trillion in the next 2 years. It accounts for the $1.5 trillion tax cut Republicans passed last year and last month's $1.3 trillion bipartisan spending bill that significantly boosts military and domestic spending. Now, this is all very concerning to one Republican who no longer has the power to do anything about it. Judd Gregg is a former governor and senator from New Hampshire. He voted for the Bush-era tax cuts, which the CBO said would add more than $1.5 trillion to the deficit in the decade after they passed. And now he's the co-chair of the Campaign to Fix the Debt, part of a nonpartisan committee for a responsible federal budget. Judd Gregg, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Happy to be on.
We're glad to have you. And when you see this CBO report this week, your thoughts are what?
That we're headed over a cliff as a nation. We're on a track that's totally unsustainable, which means that at some point in the future, we're going to have a fiscal issue that's very significant, some sort of fiscal crisis, and that we'll inevitably pass on to our children a lower standard of living because they'll have to pay down all this debt that we've run up during our generation, and pass that debt on to them. And that will reduce their standard of living. And it's not right. And we should be much more fiscally responsible than we're being as a government.
Could you play that scenario out? In your understanding of the situation, what would the economic crisis look like? Because we have had trillion-dollar debts before in the Obama administration, in war times as well, when the GDP and the deficit were closely aligned. And yet, we haven't seen the nightmarish scenarios that some economists have warned of.
Well, we haven't had what we're headed towards, which is a non-war situation where our debt-to-GDP ratio will probably exceed 100%. Historically, our debt-to-GDP ratio up until 2008 was at 35%, which made us a very strong and healthy nation. But under the Obama administration, it doubled, and now it's still going up at a very exponential rate. And is driven almost entirely by Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security spending, the three major entitlement programs, which are absorbing massive amounts of the federal budget and are not being paid for as they spend to fund these safety net programs for senior citizens. And that spending is being driven by the fact that you have the largest generation in the history of our nation retiring. So we're going from 35 million retired people to 70 million retired people, and the system isn't built to sustain that. What will happen down the road? Nobody really knows because it's never happened before, but you can logically presume that at some point there'll have to be some sort of effect on the value of the dollar. In other words, you'll get an inflationary event, and instead of paying the dollars back in the real terms of the dollars were borrowed at, they'll be paid back as inflated dollars, which means they'll be worth a lot less. And thus, people who lend us money will say, well, we're not going to lend you money unless you pay us a lot more interest. And that starts the downward spiral.
I think you brought up a very important part of this debate. And it gets into this idea of how are we going to then solve that problem if you think the problem should be solved. How do you cut entitlements, Social Security benefits, Medicare, that sort of thing? Defense spending is another one that takes up a huge part of the government's budget. How do you politically do that?
Well, first off, defense isn't an issue in this debate. It's a discretionary account, and it represents less than 15% of the federal budget. The issue, if you're going to be honest about it, is Medicare. Social Security is also a big player, but Medicare is really the driver of our debt problem because the costs of health care are escalating so fast. Do you have to cut these programs? I actually don't think you do. In fact, I served on the Simpson-Bowles Commission where we resolved the Social Security issue. We made it actuarially sound for 75 years. And we did it in a way which was not only reasonable, but it actually increased benefits to low-income people and single individuals such as surviving widows and still made the system solvent without any draconian cuts. So it can be done. Social Security is actually very fixable. Medicare, much more complicated, but it can also be addressed through changing the way we reimburse under Medicare, going from a fee-for-service system to a capitated system. Where you reward quality and outcome as versus just utilization. Those are broad terms, but that's the direction you've got to go in. The problem isn't substantive. These programs can be fixed. The problem is political. Mm-hmm. These programs have been used as a political bludgeon for years, and anybody who goes near them gets bludgeoned. Unless you do a bipartisan fix, politics will be stuck into the debate and nothing will get done.
Well, as we said, the last time the country saw trillion-dollar deficits was during President Obama's administration. And Republicans at that time were talking a lot about this issue. Here's Congressman Paul Ryan on Fox News in 2011.
The problem is if we don't get this deficit and debt under control, it really hurts our economy and job creation. Deficit reduction, debt reduction means job creation. Because every time you run a big deficit like we are now, that just means more tax increases and interest rate increases tomorrow.
Judd Gregg, a lot of people are confused by the Republican Party and Republican leaders who once in 2011 were saying that the deficit was a major problem and then have this year passed things like the $1.5 trillion tax cut and also a $1.3 trillion spending bill last month. How do you square that?
Well, on the spending side, you can't square it. On the tax side, you can. Actually, revenues are projected by CBO, the report you referred to, is going up significantly over the next 10 years, primarily due to economic growth, which they tie to the tax cuts, specifically in the corporate side. And
but not as much, not as much as Republicans promised.
Well, not as much as Republicans promised, but CBO is a Keynesian organization. They've never been a big fan. The fact that they're admitting that it happens at all, to me, is a startling admission on their part, and I think they're probably understating it. But whether they're understating it or being right, the fact is it's not a revenue issue. Revenues are going up. The problem is that spending, specifically entitlement spending, is going up much more dramatically. And the problem is that the Republican president that we have has taken Medicare and Social Security off the agenda. Why? Because as soon as they get mentioned, you got folks like Chuck Schumer, who just yesterday said, oh, they're going to cut Medicare and Social Security when the president, somebody started talking about rescissions. And so it gets demagogued. The only way you fix this, in my opinion, is to do what was attempted to do under Simpson-Bowles. You put together a group of people who are bipartisan, who know the issues, who are in the Congress, and some from outside, and you tell them, come up with a solution, fix this, and then you have an up or down vote, no amendments allowed, because if you allow amendments, people hide behind their amendments when they lose and claim they can't vote for the whole thing because their amendment failed. So you've got to do a bipartisan exercise here, and there has to be a structure, a procedural structure, which allows a bipartisan group to come to conclusions. Right now, there's no sentiment at all for that. I totally agree with the basic thrust of your question, which is that this president and this Congress have basically punted, worse than punted, really, on the issue of spending policy, and this new and this recent omnibus bill was an outrage, in my opinion. I mean, Somebody once asked me a couple week or so ago, are there any no deficit hawks left in the Senate? And I said, there are not even any deficit pigeons left in the Senate.
Well,
that's ridiculous.
That's why it's also, again, confusing to people why the House is voting tomorrow on a constitutional amendment for a balanced budget. There's some irony there, don't you think?
Yeah, well, I actually support a constitutional convention to call for a balanced budget. However, that's not going to solve the problem because it's not going to happen. I mean, that's politics.
Yeah. And how do you do that after some of the policies that just went through the Congress? I mean, it doesn't make sense exactly.
Well, I suppose you can make the argument that they need a constitutional amendment in order to protect them from themselves, so to say, because they're not capable of disciplining spending. And, you know, this is not a partisan problem. I mean, the simple fact is that not only did the Republicans throw in the towel on spending, the Democratic Party has done that very aggressively. In fact, the Democratic Party is now being dominated in its dialogue by what they call progressives, who are essentially socialists. I mean, Bernie Sanders is a socialist, but their view is that they can continue to spend profligately and let the bills go to the kids. And that's unfortunately what's happening.
That's Judd Gregg, former Republican senator and governor of New Hampshire. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for your time, Peter.
And we are going to keep talking about this. We'll have different viewpoints on the budget deficit in the coming days.
You can probably say this next fact with me. Every year, 8 million metric tons of plastic trash finds its way into the ocean, killing the wildlife, destroying our food chain. And a lot of that plastic also finds its way back up on shore, a vicious cycle, especially in developing, impoverished countries where there's not a lot of waste management. But David Katz thinks poverty and pollution can be combined in another cycle that can reduce both problems. He's the founder of Plastic Bank. This is a for-profit organization. They pay plastic collectors in an online account for plastics they've collected, and they in turn can spend that online money at the group's brick-and-mortar centers. David Katz, founder and CEO of Plastic Bank, joins us. Hi.
Hi, Robin.
Okay, so a lot of people are familiar with taking their plastic to recycling centers, and they pop them in vending machines, and maybe some change comes out, or maybe there's a company that comes, maybe it's their town, that comes and picks up their recycling. You've said that what you want to do is have the plastic accepted from people as currency in return for goods and services. What does that mean?
One of our collectors, like Lisa Nassis, she's a remarkable example of one of the collectors in our system. She makes a living by collecting material from streets or from door-to-door, business-to-business, and collects a volume of material. And at the end of the day, she brings material to us. And it's more of a community center where she's greeted, acknowledged, known, and the material is weighed. And the quality of the material is validated. And then a value, depending on the material and the type that she's brought to us, is provided to her into an online account, or she can spend it in the store. She can buy sustainable cooking fuel, Wi-Fi, cell phone minutes. In the Philippines, we offer medical insurance, access to filtered water, and we're most proud to offer school tuition.
And then you take that raw material they've brought in, that the plastic, and you turn around and sell it. This closes the loop. This is a circular economy. It sounds fantastic, but you're also doing it as a for-profit. How do you make money? Because I'm assuming that you want to give out as much as possible to the people who are bringing the plastic in.
The Plastic Bank is a for-profit organization that brokers the material that we collect as social plastic. Now, the brands that buy our material, like the German Consumer Goods Company, they buy that material as an input into their manufacturing, and they pay a social plastic rate, and we make a profit on that. And that helps us support the creation of additional collection centers. It lets us grow into more countries. It allows us to engage and educate more of our collectors.
You say they pay a social plastic rate. They pay a premium. They pay more because these companies have bought into the notion of being stewards of the earth with their consumers. And I understand you came up with this idea because it's not just that people will bring in their plastics from home. You're hoping that further they also become people who help clean up these horrible situations that they have to live in because they can make money off it.
Robin, I think that there's a great conversation in this idea that if every piece of packaging or bottle was $5, we know that there would be none in garbage cans or in the ditch or in the streets. People don't throw money away. And as we continue to reveal a value in this material resource, we see that people are beginning to keep and collect all the material they encounter. Like within the Philippines, where there's a multi-layer sachet economy.
What's a sachet?
It's a piece of aluminum coated with a piece of plastic on either side. And that little sachet traditionally holds a single service of like a shampoo or a soap package or even a ketchup, single service items, because they can't afford a big bottle. Well, before they would just discard that. And because we've created a monetary process for those, people are collecting them. They have an extra bag in their kitchen, and all of the sachets that were before going into the garbage as waste or into the canal as waste are being collected and then returned once a week or once every couple of weeks to one of our centers.
So where are you now? Where are you able to do Plastic Bank?
We're powerfully and fully executed in Haiti, in the Philippines, in the slums of Manila. We've just launched Brazil, working into Sao Paulo. And we've just launched powerfully as well into Indonesia. And that same relationship that's taken us into Indonesia is also seeding us into South Africa.
Well, and you have a huge goal, because you've said that $500 billion could alleviate all poverty around the world, all of it. And what's your goal with plastic?
All the plastic we've ever produced is really mostly still here as waste. And at a low end of 50 cents per kilogram, we could potentially be unleashing a $4 trillion value as a currency for the poor. It's not a handout. And that's the power in this being a for-profit business. We have not yet encountered anyone that has brought recycling or solid waste to the ultra-poor. We really are the Uber of recycling, allowing the poor themselves to make the most. That's been the change that the poor have been waiting for. Ultimately, we're launching a wave of entrepreneurship in solution, using the value that is inherent inside that petroleum resource.
That's David Katz, CEO and founder of Plastic Bank, the for-profit company that hopes to revolutionize recycling around the world. We'll have more at herenow.org. David, best of luck to you.
Thank you, Robin.
And your thoughts, an opportunity for the poor, or something unseemly maybe about asking them to clean up what maybe plastic producers should? Thoughts welcome, herenow.org. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.